Accession number 30063, Reel 2.
Mr. Reed, Reel 2. When did you start school, Mr. Reed?
When I was 5 years of age.
And the school you went to, do you recall it?
School I went to was on Askew Road, not far away from where we lived, possibly a half a mile. Never ever accompanied to school. We just left home and went to school and came back. No one to meet us, no one to see us. Get in the house and say, I'm here, and that was it. They never had anyone to meet you. It wasn't necessary. Coming out of school, waiting for you going into school, used to be have your breakfast, and that would be toast and whatever. Off to school, and that was it. Your parents didn't come and get you. It wasn't necessary. And then we would go to school and play in the school yard. Again, nothing growing there, just solid cement. But we'd play football and things like that in the school yard. That was when I was 5 years of age. And then when we grew, got a couple of few more years, we moved up to Windmill Hills. That was a bit further away, and it was a higher school that went on until you were 14. So from about 9 years of age, we left Askew Road and went up to the older school, which was the Windmill Hills.
What was your favourite subject or subjects?
What was
your favourite subjects? What subjects did you like?
Oh, I used to like composition. I always had difficulty with figures. I couldn't really grasp them properly. Anything that I knew about figures in later years was after I went to school, and I went to night school or something like that and looked it that way. But that was the way that happened from 5 until 9, from 9 until 14, and then I started work.
Do you have any memories of school life itself?
Yes, I have. I played football for the school. I was pretty well up in that respect. And I was pretty well known throughout not only our own community, but because of playing football, I was pretty well known with all these lads from other schools, the same way as I knew them. And some of them indeed came out to be professional footballers. I mean, proper, getting a wage of £7 a week, which was a good wage then. And generally, yeah, the school was okay, but I didn't break any eggs with sticks or anything like that.
What was the discipline like?
It was bad. You had to kowtow or else take the consequences. The main part of anything to get you to be disciplined was the strap in the smaller schools. In later on, in the higher schools, the cane was the thing, and the cane, the teacher used to get you out, put your hand out, not like that, but put your hand out great, and he used to wallop you. And it was quite severe. If you accepted the discipline and did what you did and had reasonable results, things would be okay. But there was always fighting going on in the schoolyard. If you didn't have a fight in the schoolyard, you used to say, see you at 4 o'clock. And used to see them at 4 o'clock, and half the school used to be in the ring, and here we are going to knock hell out of each other. Now that was just the school. I remember we sat exams at the end of school to think in terms of grammar school, and there was one fellow out of our class. Bearing in mind there was 42 people in the class, but there was one only, and he was always looked upon as the educated one, because he sat in the top of the class in the first thing, right in the corner at the top, and he knew everything as far as we were concerned. Philip Peel, I'll never forget his name, Philip Peel. And his they were considered to be well up in life because they had a shop, but the shop was an ordinary house that we've been talking about, and bottles of pop and sweets and things like in the front window, which was an ordinary window. So it was an ordinary house with all these things in, selling for pennies and tuppences and things. Take the bottle back and get a halfpenny on it, or a penny on it. And that was living. And everybody lived like that. Everybody lived like that.
Was he singled out because he was the brightest one in your class?
Yes. He got away with murder. But anybody else, if they did anything wrong, they would catch it.
And the classmates themselves, did they... was he bullied, for example, because he
was different? He wasn't bullied because... I think one of the reasons he wasn't bullied is because he was a big lad for his age. And he was too fat for his age. He didn't play football. He didn't go running or anything like that. He sat down and took things easy. So that was it until 14 years of age.
And what happened to you then at 14?
Started work. Here was the prime time now, where I was 14 and I was starting work, and I was going to get 15 shillings a week. I'm not sure whether it was... I think I started off on 7 and 6, and then eventually I went up to 15 shillings. But here we are, at work at 14 years of age, starting at 7 o'clock in the morning, starting at 7 o'clock in the morning, and finishing at 5 o'clock at night.
And who were you working for?
That was Procter & Gamble.
And what was your first job?
First job was on a lorry, a pop lorry, Wilkinson's Drinks. And there I worked for them, and it wasn't very nice at all. They used to have the driver and me, and I used to give out the pop when he sold a half a dozen bottles to the shop. I used to take them in and generally look after the stuff on the lorry. But that didn't last at all. From there, from the pop place, my father, still working at Procter & Gamble, or Thomas Headley, had a word with the factory manager, and said, you know, can you find an opening for my son? And he did. And I worked at Procter & Gamble, Thomas Headley. And I worked there until the war started.
So what was your first job with that company?
I was feeding machines. And that was the first job. The second job was as an office boy, to taking papers around.
You say feeding machines, what are you...
With soap. They manufactured soap. And I fed the machines with the soap. And they packaged it one way or the other, wrapped paper around it with machinery. All a mass production. There were this Procter & Gamble, Thomas Headley, were very, very well known. It was power, they were power in Newcastle. And then, of course, Procter & Gamble took them over, and they were even more so, because Procter & Gamble moved part of their offices across from Ohio and brought them to Newcastle. And they're still in Newcastle to this day, Procter & Gamble. Still, and they gradually increased and got better and better and better, and had factories built in Manchester, factories built in Dagenham. In the old days, prior to the war, they had three factories then, and they used to supply a hell of a lot of people. There were only two firms. One was Lever Brothers in Liverpool, and the other one was Procter & Gamble in Newcastle, and they were the ones really who ran the roost as far as you had Palmolive and all everything like this. But they were the big ones.
And you worked, you had to get from Gateshead to Newcastle to your work?
Sorry?
Did you work in Newcastle itself?
In Newcastle and City Road, and right in the middle of the town, mainly in the middle of the town, just on the periphery, and worked there, yes, from the time I left the Pop Place, which was insignificant, really. Time I left the Pop Place to join Thomas Headley, I worked there all the time.
And you had to be there for 7 o'clock in the morning, were you saying?
Yeah.
So how did you get from Newcastle?
Walked.
From Gateshead to Newcastle?
Walked.
That's quite a walk.
Yeah, it's a long walk. And if you heard the bell ringing, now then, where was the bell? A big bell, ding 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 ding. In other words, come on, hurry up, ding 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 ding. Come on, you'll miss it. You'll miss the boat. You'll miss the bridge to get over the town, because it was a swing bridge, and it swung horizontal with the rest of the river, so the boats could get up past the bridge. And if you missed that, you were late. You were late for work. So that was always walked back, and I remember walking there. My grandmother took me and bought a pair of boots, and they're just a little bit tight for me. It's just too tight. Oh, wear them; they'll be all right. They weren't all right, and I used to have to walk to work on sort of on needles, because the boots were... But we had a locker in Procter & Gamble, and we could use old bits of old boots to work in, and leave the new ones, the good boots, in the locker, put them on at night to tread home again. So that was it. You see, there wasn't a lot of thought given to that. I mean, nowadays you think in terms of shoes and boots, and they're all different sizes, different makes, different shapes, different ways. Not there, put them on. Oh, they'll be all right. Those are your books. So that was...
Was there a canteen in the... You know, did you take your own food?
We took our own food. But there was a canteen that we sat down in. They didn't have any food, such as sandwiches or anything to buy like that. You just sat there and had your sandwiches. So you took your sandwiches to work every morning, and you got a cup of water. Eventually, they did have a canteen, but it was not very good. We still continued to take our sandwiches, and we all had that there. So that was... Yeah.
What was working conditions like in the building?
Hard. It was hard work. Not for the likes of me, because I was still growing up, but it was still hard for me, because I was only 14 and having to do these things and run around. But some of the older chappies who worked there, they really had to work. They were down to the vests and picking big slabs of soap up to have them cut into pieces and lifting those up. That was really hard work. They had automatic machinery. Some of the girls worked there to look after that. But, you know, to keep in touch with that, you had to concentrate all day long and long hours, and you had to concentrate to make sure everything was going right.
Safety would be a problem, was it, with machinery in those days?
Very much. But they give problems, I'm not a Jew. They were very keen about safety. Very keen. It was, in that respect, it was a good firm. Still is. People died to work for Procter & Gamble. It's not there anymore now, anyway. They everyone working there were on reasonably good wages, possibly slightly higher than the norm. And they all enjoyed sort of Procter & Gamble's staff dance. Everybody used to go there with the girls. Things like that. And they used to look after their employees, but they had to work when they were supposed to be working.
So you moved on from the initial work on the machinery to, I think you said, office boy?
What
did that entail?
That included taking different odd pieces of information on paper, records, down to each department. Now, if you weigh up, they had one Oxidol, two Oxidol. So you do remember Oxidol? They had Oxidol, they had Sylvan Flakes, they had Fairy Soap, they had Scented Soap, they had possibly one or two more, but all different departments. And they all had to be looked after by one man in charge. He was the foreman, who wore white overalls, nothing else, but white overalls, just to denote the fact that he was in charge and responsible for that department. So I had to go around the different departments. That was in the space of four years, and by that time now, leaving school to the beginning of the war, 4 years, and then I was in the forces. It was strange that that time you're working, and when the war was declared, that was it. I never ever went back to Procter & Gamble during that time. I never even told them what was declared. I never even told them that I wouldn't be there anymore. I just didn't go to Procter & Gamble.
Did you say that you joined the Territorials?
Yes.
What date would this be?
Now, here was my father, who had been in the Territorials since the First World War. And he got me, sat me down on the fender by the fire, which was stainless steel, and used to polish it with the enemy. Sat down by the fire on the fire guard and told me there is going to be a war. This was 6 months, 8 months. This would probably be in about the May 1939. There is going to be a war. Whether you like it or not, you will be called up. Now, I was just an ordinary working lad then, same as everybody else. What you want to do is pick the place where you want to go to in the forces. Not in the, they didn't say forces then, they said army. Pick where you want to go to in the army. Because if you don't, The next thing you know, you'll have a letter through the letterbox saying, you have been called up for service. And if that's the case, they just get hold of you, pick you up and put you there. And you are part of that parcel there. That was your regiment. That was, you liked it or you didn't like it. It didn't make any difference. You went into the infantry. And more often than not, you would stay in the infantry. And that would be it. And your chance of surviving that lot would be very, very small. So, that was joining the territorials. He said, join the terriers, join the territorials, and you can go into the signals, radio operator, linesman for the telephone lines, whatever you want in there. And you won't be called upon to use a rifle and bayonet, because the infantry were about, charging and walking up. You've seen photographs. You've seen film reels of people walking along with the hats on and ready. Well, this, he guided me away from that, and I was doing something technical, and it was good because I was beginning to learn different things.
What unit did you join as a territorial? What unit did you join as a territorial?
What unit? I think it was the 23rd Signals. The 23rd Signals rings a bell. It does ring a bell because we were there, the Signals unit. And with the Signals unit, you were sort of doled out, like doling money out. You that's your job there in there. You'll be all right. You stay with that regiment or that whatever it was. Stay with them, and you are the means of communication between one place and another.
When your father had this discussion with you, you went straight in at that time?
More or less. I didn't dash away and say, I want to be in the terriers. But I joined. And strangely enough, 99.9% of the fellows who were in there did exactly the same as I did. Because the only other unit in Gateshead, if you like to put it that way, was the DLI.
The 9th Battalion in Gateshead.
They had a regiment in there in Gateshead. So he either went into the DLI or you went into the Signals, whatever it is.
What was the process of joining the territorials? Do you recall how you your first going to them and what happened?
I signed up.
Were you given a medical?
No medical. You just went up there and signed up. And you are now in the Territorial Army.
Where were they based? In Gateshead?
The school in Gateshead, and I can't remember the name of it, but the school up there, and it was up on the hill. I remember that vividly, because we used to do a training in the schoolyard, and we used to have broomsticks to use as rifles. And we all stood in a line, sword at the shoulder, doing commands. And he said, right, take a rest.
Just before we come to this, so you'd gone and you'd signed on, in effect, you'd signed on the territorials. Do you recall the name of the commanding officer of the unit?
Dud Rennick.
And what rank would he hold?
Captain. Dud Rennick.
What was he like?
He was no good to anybody. He was the son of the owner or something to do with a brewery, Rennick. He was either partner in a brewery or something to do with a brewery. and he was quite, he didn't have a clue. He couldn't march properly. He just didn't have a clue. He used to stutter, and he obviously got the job purely and simply because he was rich. He used to use a Jaguar in those days, in 1939. And probably take us home if you were going home for a weekend leave and pick you up and take you back again. But he was, as a captain in the army, he was bloody hopeless.
Did you see much of him in your training, in the early days?
See,
did you see much of him? Was he
not a great deal? Not a great deal. Not a great deal. No one had any real respect for him. They respected him as a captain with pips on his shoulder. And after that, the man inside was not very good. Not very good at all.
He would not register with you as the important trainer or instructor?
No. Oh, no. No. We had... the trainers we had were people who had been in the territorials for some years, like my dad and father, would treat the linesmen and explain everything to them. Radio operators, they would come along and you would start learning that. But there were people who were knowledgeable about the different various things. The captain was just a non-entity. Non-entity. And there were another two, and I forget the names now. I remember one of them, a big, tall, lanky fellow, and they were the same. You get the odd one who was dead keen and wanted to, and he did everything wrong. It was early days. You're talking with a Prunshank and you're standing on the schoolyard. The schoolyard wasn't like that. It was like that.
Sloping.
And you stand at ease on there. And before long, your leg was giving you hell, because you're standing on one leg virtually.
Did they issue you with a uniform straight away?
Yes. Not straight away, but you were just coming in the battle dress then. And yes, I got a uniform. We all got a uniform. And especially when war was declared, that was it. You got a uniform.